Good evening. My name is Laura Takachi, and I am a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. On behalf of the Clark Forum, the Milton B. Asbel Center for Jewish Life, the Center for Environmental Sustainability and Education, the Women's Center, and the Departments of Anthropology, Religion, Judaic Studies, Environmental Studies, and International Business and Management, I would like to welcome you to tonight's program, Feeding the Future. La Rochefoucauld's quote, "To eat is a necessity, but to eat intelligently is an art," could be revised to say that farming is also a necessity and one that we must perform intelligently. We may question how intelligently our current agricultural system operates and its impact on our ecosystems, communities, and economy. Tonight, award-winning writer, photographer, educator, and farmer Michael Abelman will discuss issues of urban agriculture and the cost of our current food system. From 1981 to 2001, Abelman acted as the executive director of the Center for Urban Agriculture, an important community and education center, serving as many as 5,000 people per year for tours, classes, festivals, and apprenticeships. As an author and a photographer, Abelman's work has been critically acclaimed. His 2003 book, From the Good Earth, A Celebration of Growing Food Around the World, was called inspiring by the Los Angeles Times, while the New York Times called it a compelling photographic essay. His book entitled On Good Land, The Autobiography of an Urban Farm, likewise received positive reviews. The Philadelphia Inquirer said that if Henry David Thoreau had been a farmer, he would have written a book very much like Michael Abelman's. Michael Pollan called Abelman's most recent publication, Fields of Plenty, a book of rare beauty. Abelman has received numerous awards for his accomplishments, including the Susti Award, Eating Well Magazine's Food Hero Award, and the Environmental Leadership Award from the California governor. At this time, please disable all cell phones and other electronic devices. Because this program is being taped and some of our audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before speaking during the question and answer session following the lecture. I would like to remind everyone that there will be a reception and book signing in the lobby following the event. And now, please join me in welcoming Michael Abelman.
Could we have the house lights up a little bit more? I want to be able to see you. Well, it's very nice to be here, and I actually have roots in this part of the world. I grew up in Delaware. Any of you heard of Delaware? Raise your hands. There's one back there. Yeah, okay. But I actually spent my summers part of my summers as a kid in the Pocono Mountains, have very wonderful memories of traipsing around there. So it's nice to be back. I have actually, and can you hear me okay? Does it have the same echo that I'm hearing? Yes. Would the stationary mic be better? Yes? No? Okay, we'll leave it be. I think I may bring it down just a bit here. I actually blended two talks, one that I put together called Thinking Like an Island, and the other one, Feeding the Future. So you're going to get the blend here tonight. All for the same price of admission, by the way. So, now, I live on Salt Spring Island, one of the Gulf Islands that sits between Vancouver Island and the mainland in British Columbia. There are 10,000 of us living on that island and 10,000 opinions about everything. In fact, Salt Spring Island has been referred to as an argument surrounded by water, which is a lot of truth to that. And I'm not sure why, but I've had a relationship with islands, both in the literal sense of the word and the figurative sense, since I was a young man. My attraction has not been the cliched tropical fantasy allure of palm trees and white sand and turquoise waters. It's something much deeper. Island as metaphor for our existence on Earth, representing independence and interdependence, natural limits and boundless space. Island as paradox. And living on an island, I've realized that you can't get away with anything. Every human interaction, every unnecessary material consumption, every bit of waste, every morsel of food has clear links, impacts, and reactions. The feedback loop is pretty immediate. There is no vast landmass where the ripples of one's actions and interactions can radiate over long distances and large populations in a grand anonymous dilution. And that's if you are paying attention. And if we consider the Earth itself as an island floating in a sea of space, in fact, our only ship at sea, as my friend David Brower used to describe it, we might reconsider how we take care of it. And one of the most emblematic places to start, I believe, is with our food. Now, I got involved with agriculture because I wanted to eat well, and because as a young man, I wanted a livelihood that did not require sucking the life out of the world. And I had no idea at that time that the simple act of growing food could have such a profound impact on every aspect of our lives. That there is nothing more basic, more central to our lives than how we secure our food. Now, are you guys on your computers back there? Is that some enhanced version of my talk, or what's going on? You're taking notes. Ah, see, this is a brave new world. Imagine that. I was never allowed to do such things, you know. Yet the responsibility for our food has been almost entirely handed over to someone somewhere else, to an industrial system where farms have become factories and food has become a faceless commodity. The result of this has been disastrous. Epidemic levels of childhood obesity and diabetes, food that no longer tastes good or is good for you, polluted groundwater, soil loss at staggering rates, and most profound, an almost complete disconnection from the social, cultural, and ecological connections that were once part of agrarian life. To accept food and agriculture as a keystone is to address every aspect of our lives. Now, I gave a series of talks to educators in Hawaii a couple years ago as part of a project I was involved with through the Center for Eco-Literacy, who, by the way, if you are not familiar with their work, I encourage you to check them out online. And the Polynesian people who first settled the Hawaiian Islands long ago understood how to live with limits and boundaries, how to live within the ecological limitations of where they lived. They supported a population of 1 million people on those islands without any outside inputs. There was a very well-prescribed way of living and of managing resources. If someone caught a species of fish that was out of its allowed season, that person was executed. Now, that sounds pretty radical, but they understood something that we have forgotten, that the survival of each one of us is inextricably tied to each other and to the natural world we live in. Those original island peoples knew that the greed of a few could unravel the survival of an entire society. Now, Hawaii is the most remote populated landmass on Earth, and yet it now imports close to 80% of its food from the mainland. Food is traveling close to 3,000 miles to reach its shores. And the cost of this system goes well beyond what is paid at the checkout counter, $6 a pound for potatoes, $5 for a head of lettuce. A place that has such a feeling of wealth and abundance and fecundity is one of the most food insecure places on Earth. If the ships stop sailing and the planes stop flying, it will not take very many days before the impacts become very real and very personal. Now, when I was 16 years old, I spent time on another island, the island of Jamaica, helping my brother develop a small piece of land he owned outside of Negril. We were taken in by Gretel Hilton and her partner, Uncle Will, who patiently instructed us in some basic survival. How to sharpen a machete, open a coconut, what herbs to use if you were injured or sick, how to cook breadfruit, and how to fish from the cliffs along the sea. They must have felt responsible for us, two young white boys not particularly well adapted to Jamaican bush life. At the time, I'm sure that I viewed their world and the knowledge they had of that place as necessary, but somewhat quaint, maybe even a little backwards, a far cry from where the world was going. I had no idea at that time that I would eventually devote my life to learning those very skills, writing and teaching about the critical importance of rediscovering our place in nature and knowing how to grow food. And my generation was in the early stages of what is now a total worship of technology. Just proves my point, see? We were invested in our own human cleverness, believing, as Wes Jackson has said, it was far greater than nature's wisdom. We didn't realize the ecological and social price we would all pay for this arrogance. And Gretel Hilton and Uncle Will were still immersed in the natural history of a place we call Jamaica. And they were not alone. At that time, most rural families were fairly self-sufficient, still had chickens and goats, a breadfruit tree, coconut trees, mango, a little cultivated yam and greens. And if they lived near the coast or a river, they fished. Now, I returned to Jamaica several years ago after more than 30 years to work on an agricultural and community development project. And much has changed there as it has everywhere. Most profound is that natural self-sufficiency that was so much a part of my experience back then is now the exception rather than the norm. The potential for abundance is still there, supported by a tropical climate, rich soils, and plentiful water. But that self-reliance, especially in regards to food, has been replaced by a total dependency on imports from abroad. Now, taste and smell have an uncanny ability to form the basis for memory. Prior to my return to Jamaica, I looked forward to the taste of a nation that had so acutely lodged in my subconscious. The intense, rich flavors of real banana and pineapple. Oranges so ugly, but so incredibly rich in flavor. Mango like dirt, and while poverty in the economic sense of the word was endemic then as it is now, this diversity and food quality was a form of national wealth embodied by rural communities that prided themselves on the variety and quality of their fruits and knowledge and an intimacy with a place. And sadly, I have not rediscovered the taste of those foods. So much of the fruit I find there now is not that different from the exported tropical products you find sitting on a shelf in some store in Philadelphia or Vancouver or Los Angeles. Sound familiar? Now, a farm is like an island. When run well, a farm should strive to be self-contained, self-sustaining, its nutrient loop closed and fulfilled from within, not reliant on external inputs. This is farm as ecological system. But in a world where only 1% of us is growing the food for the rest, farms have a greater cultural and educational role in society as well. There are now far more people in prisons than there are growing food, far more computer programmers, lawyers, and stockbrokers than there are farmers. And as such, a farm must now extend itself beyond the borders of its fields, educate as well as feed what is now a predominantly urban world. I spent 25 years developing a small 12.5-acre farm and education center in California. Floating in a sea of tract homes and shopping centers, this farm was another type of island. And I'm sorry, I had two slides which I normally show, which show the that farm from the air in 1954 and the same farm, same perspective in 1998, and you would not believe it. It's quite dramatic. Now, during its heyday, 12.5 acres produced 100 different fruits and vegetables, employed 30 people, provided food for 500 families, and generated close to $1 million in gross income. Zoned for 52 condominiums, threatened with development, we formed a nonprofit organization, the Center for Urban Agriculture. And against all odds, raised $1 million to save that land, placing it under one of the first active agricultural conservation easements in the country. One that not only preserved that land in agriculture, but required specific social and ecological principles for that agriculture, and went even further, required that that land be used for community programs and place-based education as well. And this all took place well before many of the conversations that are happening in the last 5 years or so. But during the years when the rich land surrounding that farm were being paved over and built on, I watched folks in that neighborhood, heads down, going about their daily business, the years clicking by, and then one day looking up and around to discover that everything had changed. And those dramatic changes, changes that are happening everywhere, took place over a relatively short period of time. They took place in broad daylight. Now, farming is challenging enough, but to constantly have to defend that farm's right to exist was difficult. It wasn't just the public battles over roosters or compost or having to raise $1 million to save the land from the developers. Those challenges were not small, but they were clear and they were easy to grasp. It was the internal struggles of farming in a suburban environment that eventually got to me. I found myself longing to live and farm someplace where folks still took time with each other, where one's sense of responsibility extended beyond the edges of the lawn. I was almost 50 and wanted to experience land ownership, something that had become an impossible dream in much of California. I now realize it's a highly overrated state, ownership. So we moved 1,200 miles north to Salt Spring Island. And I remember the feeling of getting on that ferry early on. It was like pulling up the drawbridge. There was this sense that we were leaving the madness of the world behind. Island as refuge. But I soon discovered the great paradox, that those things I thought I was leaving behind were right there as well, and in ways that were more difficult to ignore. Living on an island, I discover, forces you to engage more than disengage. And when I first moved, I was surprised to discover this huge, decrepit industrial facility, belching millions of tons of pollutants right off our shores. And the Crofton pulp mill became my most direct daily reminder that duality exists everywhere. I'd ask people about the mill, and few seemed concerned. "It's always been there," they'd say. "The economy depends on it. We don't notice it anymore. They've cleaned it up." These things I was told repeatedly. The stories we tell ourselves that allow us to accept what we believe we cannot change. But when the facility proposed the burning of tires, railroad ties, and coal in their power boiler, a few of us became sufficiently outraged that we took action, eventually organizing a clean air concert with Neil Young to raise money and awareness around a major polluting industry that had become invisible like wallpaper. You probably have a few things like that around here, huh? I just was reminded today that we are very close to Three Mile Island. I had forgotten about that. That's correct, huh? Yeah. Now, there was a little satisfaction in taking on the mill and preventing them from doing the unthinkable. But in truth, it should have been shut down. The real lesson was that as an island, we are not apart. We are not isolated. We share the same air, the same water, the same atmosphere. Thinking like an island requires that we accept conflict and contradiction, accept that there is nowhere to go, nowhere to run, accept the fact that we are more ignorant than knowledgeable, and that we need to act accordingly. For our first 6 years on the island, we developed a wonderful piece of bottomland, then moved to the Foxglove Farm on Mount Maxwell. Now, foxglove, or digitalis, as you probably know, is used in medicine to restore human heart function. And we inherited that farm name, and we intend to keep it, as it is places like that that are helping to restore the heart function to the world. We have established the Center for Arts, Ecology, and Agriculture, which now brings artists, writers, musicians, foresters, farmers, chefs, and watershed experts to share their knowledge within the context of this wonderful 120-acre working landscape. Real working place-based art, forestry, food, and agriculture education. And we have just completed our fourth season farming on that land. And while this is like starting over again, there is a great deal of help embodied in that land from those who came before us. The original homesteaders who chose to settle that land probably did not do so for the view or because it was private. They selected that site because they thought they could survive there. Surprising that at 1,200 feet on the side of a mountain, there is such energy and possibility, but it's there. And if we had known how much manure was left in those old barns when we took over, we'd have probably offered the previous owner more money for the land. The biology is also in our favor. Our farm fields are surrounded and intersected by swaths of intact forest. And my sense is that the fields and forest are wired together, connected, I am sure, but in ways I don't totally understand. And when the fall rains begin, the entire place is transformed into this enchanted world where chanterelle and shaggy parasol and hedgehog and cauliflower mushrooms pop up everywhere. My mind's eye imagines this vast network of mycelium, miles of tiny threads moving from forest to field, providing the underpinning for soil and plant health. And our first season produced spinach with leaves the size of dinner plates, raspberries and asparagus planted in June that looked like three-year-old plants by September. Potatoes and tomatoes and French melons and strawberries showed no humility or self-control, producing an obscene volume and size. And I felt like the ringmaster of some sort of fruit and vegetable circus where all the performers had gone off on their own tangents. And at the farmer's market, I was accused of operating a secret genetics lab at our place. But the most wonderful part of that first year on that land was the quiet glimpses into the past that appeared in unexpected ways. The sense that we are a part of a long chain of humans on that land, from the native people who fished its creek and lake, to those who built the original homestead, to ourselves, each link has been informed by the past and by the land itself. And I believe that that land chooses and dreams us as much as we choose it. Wherever I worked on that land, rebuilding a fence, restoring an old building, preparing a field, I encountered the remnants of those who worked that land before me, discovered someone else's dream from some time in the past, and now we impose our own. And I've always emphasized the importance of land tenure as a critical principle for creating a truly sustainable agriculture. But now I wonder what land tenure really means. After all, we are all just passing through, temporary tenants and caretakers of a larger natural force. And all that will ultimately remain is the land, and the best that we can do is to leave it more fertile, more alive, more biologically diverse than we found it, and to use our brief time on the land to feed and to nourish and to inspire. Now, I have two sons. One is 28, and one is 8. It's my version of long-term crop rotation. And while I remain hopeful that at least one of them will eventually take over the farm, I suspect that after watching how hard we work, they may want something else. And I always thought that if you wanted your kids to farm, then don't raise them on one. But the question of succession has become very real and personal for me lately as I get older. I've always said that the best way to get young people into agriculture is to demonstrate that you can make a decent living doing it. And I still believe that, and a large part of my work is in creating and putting forth some of the successful models. But my sense about how to communicate this is changing. I used to think if I could just tell folks why it was important to consider another way, if I could be more eloquent in my expression, if I could just convince them, beat them into submission, that things would change. And now I think if I could just grow the best tomato. You see, I've realized that pleasure is a much greater motivator for change than guilt. Think about it. How successful has the last 30 years of the environmental movement really been? There's been some amazing work done by many of my friends and colleagues, battles won, pristine places preserved, a greater awareness of the awesome threats to our biosphere instilled in the minds of many. But most of the messaging has been all doom and gloom. And while folks have come to understand the problems, they too often feel helpless when it comes to the solutions, paralyzed in the face of the enormity of our modern dilemma. And clearly, all the well-planned environmental campaigns, all the creative strategies, all the books and organizations have only succeeded in preserving and protecting and restoring a few bits and pieces and specks. isolated victories, all while the world's natural systems unravel at a staggering rate. So how do we provide an invitation rather than a harangue? How do we provide an invitation rather than a harangue? Well, I got it standing on my farm last spring. I was out there with the deafening sound of thousands of frogs fornicating in my ponds, earthworms doing it beneath my feet, mason and bumble and honeybees fighting to stuff themselves into every flower in sight. And I suddenly realized, I'm not farming. I'm presiding over one big giant orgy. I realized that every form of life on my farm is absolutely immersed in this incredible humming, buzzing, and vibrating vortex of lust. So all this time I've had it wrong. I've been trying to entice young people back into agriculture with all the wrong messages, when all they really needed to know is that there's all this sex happening on farms. I have a much longer rap on that topic, but I will spare you. That's another talk. Well, we are living, as you all well know, on the cusp of, I believe, one of the most significant global changes since the onset of the Industrial Revolution. I think everyone here is acutely aware of climate change, a looming energy crisis, population increases in parts of the world at unbelievable rates. We know that the most fundamental elements of life, such as soil and water and clean air, are under unprecedented assault. So if we are going to be able to feed the future, we might start out by asking some questions. How will we create a food system that is more appropriately and geographically integrated with a world population that is now predominantly urban? How do we work within a private property structure where farmable land is owned and controlled by folks who, for the most part, do not farm? How do we grow food within the ecological limitations of where we grow it? And I'm talking about oil and water and minerals. How do we respond to climate change from the perspective of food production? And I think you may or may not know that food production, and especially grain, is extremely temperature sensitive. It has a very narrow temperature range for good pollination. And grain, being such a cornerstone of our diet, will be very directly impacted as temperatures and climate changes. And, of course, smaller regional farms have the ability to navigate this. How do we balance our need to preserve and protect farmland with the reality that it is far easier to save land than it is to save farmers? And after all, what good is a protected farm if you don't have someone to steward it? How do we inspire and ensure that the next generations will want to work on the land? How do we provide access to land for that next generation? As I said, I think that ownership as a dominant model is definitely highly overrated. I think there are much more interesting models and more possible models for beginning farmers, which we can hopefully talk about in a bit. Whose hands will do the work of growing and harvesting our food? How do farmers survive financially while helping to assure that everyone has access to fresh food? How do we work within the laws and the attitudes of a nation that actually guards the borders to keep out the very people whose hands help grow our food? And this, I believe, is one of the elephants in the room. And I think you know what I'm talking about. I mean, each year there is a vast migration across the frontera between Mexico and the United States of people who are risking their lives to cross the border to do the work that Americans will no longer do. It's a huge issue, whether you are an organic farmer or otherwise. The majority of food, every morsel of food that most of us eat, has been touched to some degree by one of those people. That is how the system is working here now. So, how do we educate a public that the illusion of cheap food, and by the way, we pay less per dollar than any nation in the world, is paid for in less obvious ways many times after we leave the checkout counter? And what will it mean to be a farmer in coming years? And here's some of my ideas. Now, this is my crazy manifesto, and I'm going to go through each of them. Every community and every municipality should begin immediately to establish publicly supported agricultural training centers in central and accessible locations. Now, I'm not talking about think tanks or demonstration gardens. I'm talking about centers based on real working integrated farms that model not only the social and cultural and ecological benefits of farming, but the economic benefits as well. These centers should model the range of scales and possibilities from growing food in your backyard or on your balcony to full-scale multi-acre ground-level production to rooftop production. They should model not just fruits and vegetables, but the more fundamental and necessary elements of the human diet, such as small-scale grains and pulses and meat and egg and dairy production. Folks are now so removed from this work that they need to literally see what's possible. They need access to those who have maintained this knowledge and those who are serious and active practitioners. We need to reinstate a new type of extension service, not focused solely on farming, but on food, one where extension agents are well-trained food system practitioners and thinkers. And this extension service should have a mandate to provide technical support to both urban and rural food systems of every scale, from larger homes to home production gardens, with a specific focus on production for regional consumption. Every community across North America should have a team of these advisors in numbers proportionate to its population. And these agents would operate out of their local agricultural training centers, running workshops and classes and going out in the community to provide on-site technical support in production, processing, and marketing. Now, here's one that will surprise you. I happen to believe that full-time farmers in the future should no longer grow fruits and vegetables. Hang on. That should be the responsibility of individuals and families to do for themselves in their front and backyards, on their balconies or their rooftops and in community plots. Now, there has been entirely too much energy and focus in this movement on growing foods that we actually could survive without. You know, we can all live without another carrot or tomato, but we can't live without the protein sources. And from a resource perspective, we're probably going to have to focus on those protein sources that are plant-based. There are so few of us growing food for so many, the stress involved with bringing highly perishable products to the public is like delivering some organ transplant to the hospital. It's nuts. Everyone should be growing these things for themselves. I didn't get any gasps from you guys. I'm surprised. The nutrient cycle that once tied farms with those they supplied has been interrupted. We need a full-cycle food system that allows for the return of organic waste via central regional composting facilities that can support the nutrient needs of both urban, urban fringe, and rural farms. Every community could be composting all of their cardboard, paper, old clothing, shoes, restaurant, and store waste, and on and on. We need to reduce what comes into our communities from elsewhere, but we also need to reduce what leaves those communities, especially if it has nutritional or soil conditioning values for our land. Now, I don't know about the fields here, but my fields at home have as many rocks as grains of soil. And removing those rocks represents a huge amount of work for me. And in fact, every year, it's as if they continue to grow. But they also, each one of those rocks also represents embodied energy, okay? If I could just release it. Now, I feel that every community could have a portable rock grinder that could be taken to farms and used to provide a local mineral source. And what you probably don't know is that there are huge holes in the world, entire mountains removed to provide minerals for our farms. And we cannot talk about a sustainable agriculture unless we address where the minerals, and especially phosphorus, are going to come from. Now, most of you have heard about peak oil, and hopefully you've been talking about peak water. We need to consider peak phosphorus as a real issue. And we can grow food without oil, but we cannot grow food without phosphorus. Now, I don't know if you realize it, but the U.S. has, I think, something like 8 or 10 mines for the entire country. most of them based in the state of Florida, much of which, the material from which is almost completely depleted. They estimate 10 to 30 years at max. And the cost now of extracting that material is going up because the quality of phosphorus and the quality of rock is going down. This is a huge issue. China holds probably the most phosphorus reserves in the world, but is now closing down that resource for good reason. And the Western Sahara, which is now controlled by Morocco, is an enormous resource. We were talking about this earlier. This is a big deal, especially when you consider that on one hand we have phosphorus polluting our oceans and rivers from the runoff from farms. On the other hand, we have a looming crisis of significant proportions, the problem that no one has heard about, something to think about. I suspect what may happen is that we may have to get over our phobia around human waste and stop spending billions of dollars to flush it away and pollute our rivers and oceans and start recycling it onto our farms and gardens. I know that sounds radical as well, but the truth is that urine, human urine, is the best local source of phosphorus and one that could be quickly captured with some creative ways. I think that we may have to consider that in the future. The Chinese have been using human waste for years, not so much recently, but when it is handled properly, it is quite safe. Every community should support the construction and funding of a permanent covered year-round farmers market in a dominant central location. And this type of physical space should be recognized as equally, if not more important, to our civic health as the public swimming pool, the sports fields, schools, churches, and libraries. Every new permit for a home or housing development should be required to have an approved food production component on a scale relative to the number of people who will be living there. And every new commercial office and retail building and every new warehouse should be engineered to have full-scale rooftop food production, including greenhouses heated by the spent heat from the buildings. Every community should initiate a phase-out of all lawns effective immediately. But here's the important part. But the important part is that they must provide neighborhood training programs and technical support for home and building owners to replace those lawns with food production. It's easy to say take the lawns out, but I think we need to provide the support to make that happen. Every neighborhood school, church, and sport facility should be required to restructure existing food service facilities to accommodate cooperative canning, freezing, and dehydrating services for their neighborhoods and communities during non-peak evening and weekend hours. Every real estate transaction should have a 1% farmland preservation tax from which lands could be purchased specifically for the production of food. And those lands should have protective covenants or easements that require that they be used for agriculture in perpetuity. Thank you. At least there is at least one person that agrees with that. Now, there is a lot of privately owned arable land lying fallow that could be creatively made available to new farmers under long-term leases. We need to recognize that there is not necessarily any relationship between land ownership and land stewardship. The only requirement for land ownership in our society is access to capital. I don't believe that's enough. I believe that ownership of land should come with a set of responsibilities. We now have building inspections as common practice prior to many real estate transactions. We should require land inspection, including ecological assessments and baseline documentation on every piece of land over 5 acres. Every land purchaser should be required to attend a stewardship and restoration training course based on the particularities of that piece of land. And this would go a long ways towards moving land from its unfortunate status as commodity and bring some sense of stewardship into ownership. Now, when I was in school, my favorite classes were wood shop, metal shop, mechanics, even home ec, which included cooking and sewing, much to the concern of my male classmates. Those subjects were well respected at that time, and I actually looked forward to shop class far more than I did math or science or English. It was a time when I could make something real and tangible. And actually, every woodshop teacher I had had one or two missing fingers. And I'm really convinced that that was a requirement for applying for those jobs. But I made the connection very quickly between those missing fingers and those machines that we worked with. But I propose, and it's beginning to happen, that we bring that type of real living skills back into the schools. We need more farming and cooking and gardening and building courses in the schools. But here's the important part. We need those subjects to be given the same status and attention that is now given to math or English or the sciences. After all, who is going to do the work in the future? Now, someone pointed out to me today that the Army has a college here in Carlisle as well. And I happen to believe that the best conflict strategy is one that supports a healthy environment and provides for people's needs. The resources consumed in this country to study, equip, and manage war is staggering. There is a lot of talent and brain power involved in this. I think we should take some of that creativity and retrain a percentage of our military for environmental restoration of degraded wildlands and farmlands and to rebuilding our nation's railways. Now, why do I say that? Aside from some obvious things, we have forgotten that until the 1980s, most food was transported by rail, an incredibly efficient means of providing a diverse diet regionally, not just locally. And before that, going back thousands of years, native people traded diverse foodstuffs over very long distances. A local diet is not always an inclusive diet. Local food too often is an experience only available to those who have the time and the money. A much more inclusive movement would use the word regional, supported by food sheds that include a broader, more diverse biofood production area. And I have to say that I don't actually like people buying my food out of some belief system or out of some sense of charity. I say buy local food if it's the best food, and if not, get it from somewhere else, even if that somewhere else is far away. That will force farmers to do a really good job, I can tell you that. Now, there have been some notable and honorable efforts to rectify the gap between those who can afford good food and those who cannot. But too often, they repeat the most common mistakes of every well-intentioned development project. We cannot socially or culinarily engineer good food into the lives of other people. We cannot build bridges between classes and races and cultures solely with quiche and arugula and heirloom tomatoes. What we can do is reach out to youth, provide programs in the schools, and most important, provide land and technical support for folks to grow for themselves. In October of 2001, I gave a speech in San Francisco in which I proposed that in memory of the thousands of people who lost their lives at the World Trade Center, that a portion of that site be devoted to an urban farm replete with greenhouses and kitchens and an education center, and that that farm be established to provide food and jobs year-round to those in need, and that it become a model of a local agricultural-based economy on the grounds of what used to be a monument to the global economy. Now, my idea was put forth more as metaphor than with any serious expectation that it would be considered, but a couple of organizations in New York City picked it up, and the proposal was officially submitted. The New York Times covered the idea, and there were hundreds of letters in support. But in the end, what was approved was, I think, something like 1,492 stories of cold steel, glass, and concrete. And it was business as usual. Now, had that proposal been put forth today, it would have received a much more positive reception. Awareness around food and its place in our lives and the incredibly precarious nature of the system that brings it to us has exploded. Language that many of us have been using for decades is now part of the public lexicon. Everyone seems to be talking the talk. But talk is cheap. And while there is an overwhelming embrace of local food and agriculture, especially amongst foodies, there is an enormous chasm between those who eat well and locally and those and can afford to do so and those who cannot. The nutritional divide has never been greater, the number of hungry people in the world growing at staggering rates. How is this possible at a time when so many people are waking up? How is it possible that there can be such an uprising of people who are passionate, enthusiastic, and inspired by the new food movement, and yet so few people whose hands are actually in the soil doing the work. So while I am thrilled that a movement that I've been so much a part of for so long is finally getting its due, I am equally concerned that so few of us are actually doing the work of farming. So in the end, there is not so much a food crisis or an environmental crisis as there is a crisis in participation. We now have a couple generations who no longer know how to use their hands for anything other than pushing keys on a keyboard. The revolution may be talked about online, but it cannot take place online. And I used to like to say that chefs had received almost mythical rock and roll status, and that it was time for farmers to receive that same attention. But the real shift we need cannot take place when only 1% of us is doing the work to grow the food for the rest, while everyone else is cheering us on. Believe me, I love the attention, but farming is not a spectator sport. So I've been telling folks to make friends with a farmer. You're going to need them. For I am certain that as the current global industrial experiment continues to unravel, agriculture will once again return to its rightful place, to the heart and the center of our society. The leadership and funding that is going to make this happen is not going to come from government, from someone somewhere else. It will have to come from folks like you sitting in this room tonight. And as you probably know, in 1989, the island of Cuba faced mass starvation, the result of having lost access to food and agricultural supplies from the former Soviet Union. Cuba responded by creating a world-class model of urban and rural agriculture based on low and no input systems. The Cubans did not green their agricultural system because it was the right thing to do. They did it because they had to, because they were going to starve to death. And I do not believe that the kind of major structural change that will be required to sustainably feed the future will happen here until it has to either, until the impacts become personal. And I realize that this is not a particularly hopeful thought. But the hopeful piece is that humans have an incredible capacity for compassion, ingenuity, creativity, and resourcefulness, qualities that come out especially under duress and crisis. And there are many historical examples of this when normal day-to-day reality is suspended and people come together. What will be missing when we can no longer rely on all the technology, all the dependency on someone somewhere else, all the infrastructure that brings us basic transportation and food and shelter, is the knowledge, the wisdom, the basic skills required to live on this earth. So those of us who are re-educating ourselves, rediscovering our place in nature, must work to refine our skills and diligently work to create the local and regional models. For I am sure that the day will come when we will be sought after, looked to for leadership and guidance, when our farms will be the living models, the repositories that kept this sacred and essential knowledge alive. Thinking like an island, imagining our world floating like a ship in an infinite sea of space, its soils and water and atmosphere finely tuned, carefully balanced to support life, provides us with some sense of boundaries and hopefully the humility to recognize the fragile nature of our existence. Thank you so much. Now, I don't know if we've run out of time for slides, but there are probably 10 or 12 minutes of slides. Do you want to go on to the Q&A?
No.
Slides. Well, you don't want to hear yourselves talk, or what? What's the deal here? Okay, we'll do slides. I'm going to shift things around so that this light is not on the screen. I hope. Could we have the house lights all the way down, please? All the way, all the way, all the way, all the way. Thank you. And these up front here as well, please. Thank you. That's great. All the way. Oh, how do you like that? Well, we're losing the first. There we go. I can't tell if that's focused or not, but Let me just give you a quick introduction here. These are images and narrative based on my last book, Fields of Plenty, that was drawn from an extraordinary journey I did with my son Aaron through the U.S. and Canada, visiting some really amazing individuals, people who had not only mastered the production of certain signature products, but who were also using their farms as platforms for social and ecological change and for education. Incredibly passionate folks, and I'm going to just introduce you to a few of them and read some of the narrative that goes with the... So this is Richard DeWild, who farms a couple hours outside of Madison, Wisconsin. Richard drives us around in his Chevy pickup to check out some of the 39 fields of vegetables that are scattered around the valley. There's a case of 30-08 Springfield silver tip rifle cartridges sitting next to the four-wheel drive shift, a bag of tobacco and some rolling papers, and a single Cipollini onion sitting on the seat. Now, I don't normally get all gaga about kale, but the field we're looking at is as deep a green as anything I've ever seen. And not the kind of artificially pumped up rank green that comes from too much ammonium nitrate or urea. This one is deep and blue and forest-like. The plants are vibrant and well-formed with huge turgid leaves, each plant standing up straight as if they've been told to pose for my cameras. Richard tells me he gets snapshots in the mail of someone's kid eating a piece of their squash or corn or carrot. There's an enclosed note that says that this is Johnny's first meal. 18 years later, and they're providing the food for Johnny's wedding. At the market, his customers will introduce their kids to our farmer. There's these beaming kids standing there that have been raised on his food. He tells me it makes him feel 10 feet tall. Now, how many people have that kind of job satisfaction? It's pretty good, huh? Born in Idaho. Now, do these look okay? I can't actually tell. Can you see them all right? All right. Born in Idaho, raised in potato fields, Gene Thiel comes from four generations of root people. And ask any chef or farmer's market regular in Portland, Oregon, where they get their potatoes. And they'll tell you matter-of-factly, from the potato man. Thiel farms at 4,600 feet in the mountains of eastern Oregon, taking advantage of a perfect convergence of ideal potato conditions, a blend of high elevation, deep glacial soils, clean and abundant fresh water, and low humidity. It's rewarding to go to restaurants and markets and find people who really appreciate what you're growing, Gene reflects. It's fundamental. We need that sustenance, that connection, that completion. When you produce a product and they see its value, it's like searing truth. They taste that truth. It's the ultimate compliment. Whoop. Lost my place here. Everything at Stratford Dairy in Vermont is run on gravity. The milk moves downhill from the milking barn to the cooling tanks, then on to the bottling and ice cream rooms without the use of a single pump. Whoop. When the pastures were cleared, trees were left strategically. So as the shade moved across the pasture, so would the cows. Now, at first, I marveled at these simple innovations. And then I realized that it doesn't exactly require a master's degree in industrial design to figure out that using gravity is a good idea, or that trees provide shade and that cows will follow. It's just that so much of agriculture has lost any relationship to common sense. We've got this idea that things need to be complicated to be any good, that simple solutions can't possibly be as good as technological ones. Earl Ransom runs the 30-cow Guernsey dairy herd, selling milk in glass bottles just like the milkman used to drop off in front of my house when I was growing up. The farm also produces premium ice cream made with the eggs from older brother Barry. Of all the things I'd like to give my boys, I want them to be able to die as old men on this land, Earl's wife Amy tells me. I also want them to be respectful, she says. I want to make pickles, and I want to personally eliminate all the flies from this farm with my swatter. Simple needs, huh? Got to find my water here. Jennifer Green farms alone, producing 30 different grains with a team of horses. She does her own milling and produces pancake mixes and polentas and breakfast cereals, which she provides to the 200 families in San Francisco who are members in her grain share program. Now, we often agonize over the quality of our vegetables or fruit, wax eloquently over cheese or wine, but accept flowers, edible seeds, and cereals that are rarely fresh and come from a limited diversity of plants. Excuse me. Jennifer's 30-acre canvas is filled with one-third to one-half-acre plots of amaranth, barley, millet, teff, heirloom wheats, blue and yellow popcorns, garbanzos, lentils, and fava beans, all merging and mingling together. In the spring before our visit, the pear and apple trees on Bob and Eileen and Selena Lane's place were loaded with fruit. Special attention was paid to the orchard, to disease and pest control, to summer pruning, and to the very time-consuming, expensive job of fruit thinning. By late July, the Lanes were preparing for the largest crop they had ever had, and doing as most of us would, quietly planning on what they would do with the much-needed extra income. Tuesday, July 26th, was clear and sunny and hot. Work had wrapped up early, and the small crew was hanging out talking near the house. There was a distant rumbling, and a mellow thunderstorm began. Then the sky turned black, the temperature plummeted 30 degrees, and lightning came down in sheets. At 3:15, the hail came, large hail, hail up to a half inch in diameter. Exactly 13 minutes later, the hail stopped, the sky cleared, the sun came out, and the Lane's fruit crop was destroyed. Eli Zabar is not a farmer. He is a successful baker and retailer with several stores in Manhattan that feature products from his own kitchens, bakeries, and now from over half an acre of his own rooftop gardens. Now, these gardens aren't just some passing novelty trial experience. Zabar invested in installing steel beam reinforcements for the rooftops above his bakeries, where pipes carry the spent heat from the ovens into the greenhouses. Winter tomatoes and salad greens are produced by two full-time rooftop farmers. Ask anyone in northern Wisconsin what to grow, and they'll likely tell you milk cows or corn. No one would ever suggest sheep. And if they did, it certainly would not be for milk or for cheese. Uh-oh. Now, that's one you have to turn on your side for. So when Mary and David Falk launched their sheep dairy operation, their neighbors thought they had lost their minds. Now, this ain't no high-tech, heavily capitalized dairy operation. From the Orv's pizza truck turned cooler to the homemade milking platform, everything has been patched and pieced and thrown together. The cheese is truly adventurous. Wrapped in vodka-soaked nettles aged on cedar boughs, if you've been raised in white bread America eating individually wrapped sliced Swiss and orange cheddar singles, you'd probably think twice if you saw the Fox cheese. Brown and crusty with ruts and holes, blue and white with brown streaks covered in leaves, they look like some bad experiment gone awry. Mary's own mother told her they look like moldy horse turds. But their customers seek out their classic homely and ugly look, and the cheeses have won numerous national awards. Farmer John Thurman chuckles as he tells me, "We're sure not keeping up with the Joneses," nodding towards the three rusting 20-foot trailers that house he and his wife Ida and their seven children. At night, we gather outside to talk. I take out one of my harmonicas to entertain the kids and begin to blow a slow blues in the key of G. Ida rolls her eyes with pleasure. When I play the final note, she tells me that it reminds her of her roots in Mississippi and the old-timers who used to sit around telling stories and playing music. Considering the poverty that exists here, I'm amazed to discover how much of John and Ida's time and energy goes into community projects, teaching local youth how to grow food, providing fresh vegetables to seniors, organizing a black farmers cooperative. John describes the farm as, quote, nothing special, just a group of hardworking people trying to make something beautiful. And each week, John and Ida and their kids trek into Chicago to sell collards and sweet potatoes and beans and melons and pasture-raised chicken to the all-black Austin Farmers Market in a neighborhood that does not have a single grocery store. Ken Dunn farms in the city of Chicago in the shadow of Cabrini Green, the 16-story prison-styled wired-covered housing project, built in the 50s to warehouse the city's poor and unemployed. Dunn's 2 1-acre plots boast 30 varieties of heirloom tomatoes, striped German, Brandywine, green zebra, black Russian, growing in the composted remains of rejected apple and cherry pie filling, and the uneaten arugula salads and filet mignons from local high-end restaurants. 5 tons of compost made from Chicago's waste has been laid down over this site, just a fraction of the 15,000 tons of urban waste that is disposed of in this city each and every day. The ground feels like a sponge, and if I plug my ears, it would feel as if I was walking on the floor of some virgin forest. The tomatoes don't seem to mind the constant noise or bad air or the poverty that surrounds their little island. The plants are tall and robust and absolutely loaded. Their world is rich in nutrients, reflected warmth and light from pavement and buildings, and the attentions given to them by local chefs, who are thrilled to tell their clientele that the tomatoes on the menu were harvested down the street. Hilario Alvarez slipped over the border into the U.S. 20 years ago to work in America's fields. He had nothing. Now he owns his own farm and employs over 100 people. Alvarez's pepper field is like some out-of-control block party. 85 varieties, many of his own selections, are thrown together in an 8-acre burlesque of color and shape. There is humor in this field, a former migrant's statement on the ultra-linear, monocultural, totally predictable fields of America's industrial agriculture. I tell Hilario he is crazy, that I've never seen anything like this before, that he should quit harvesting peppers and open the field up as a seasonal museum. I imagine docents giving tours, stopping along the rows to discuss the history and culture and use of certain varieties, the arrangement of color and shape, what the farmer was going through in his life when he planted this section or that, as if they are standing at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, analyzing a Matisse or a Van Gogh. And finally, George and Anna Zebrov, Russian Dukhobor fruit farmers in British Columbia. As we are preparing to leave, George pulls me aside. You have eaten our apricots fresh and dried. You drank our apricot nectar and even tried the kernels. But there is one thing left. There's a slightly mischievous tone in his voice as he guides me to the front of the house. There on the stump of a cherry tree, now used as a table, is a bucket of fresh warm goat's milk, a small container of amber honey, a few spoons and glasses, and a tall glass bottle filled with a clear liquid. This, he tells me, is apricot elixir. There is ritual to all of this. In Russian, he asks his young grandson to demonstrate. With a spoonful of honey in one hand and a glass of warm milk in the other, the young boy alternates back and forth. Then comes the elixir. George mixes it with goat's milk and we toast. It is a powerful drink, but it goes down easy. He pours another and we drink again. I protest when he offers me a shot without the milk. He insists, and we drink again. It is hot, we have a long drive, and I haven't had much to eat. Grapevines and cherry and apricot and apple trees swirl beneath us in a carpet of green. Children roll and giggle in a nearby hammock. Freshly dug potatoes and greens and meats are being prepared for Sunday dinner. And I am back as a child with my Russian-born grandparents, sitting at their table, drinking and eating and sharing. Thank you again. House lights. Now, I think we may. Are we out of time for Q&A, or can we have a few? Oh, we have a little bit of time here.
Yeah, we have some time left.
Yeah, good.
So during the question and answer session, please raise your hand and wait for a microphone to reach you before speaking, and we will be giving priority to Dickinson students and faculty and then community members.
Where are you guys going? This is the best part. It is. Come on. Somebody has a question here, I'm certain. Up, way up at the top.
If I didn't get it wrong, you said it's better for us to, for every family to have a garden and for every people to grow food to feed ourselves. And do you think it's like come back to the Asian world? Do you think it will have any influence to our economy, to our society? Or do you think it will harm our economy?
I didn't get all of that, I'm sorry, but was the question, can you just ask the question again a little bit slowly for me? Sorry.
I thought you said it's better for every family to have a garden and grow food for ourselves.
Fruits and vegetables.
But do you think it will have any influence on our economy and our society?
Okay, good
and
question.
And do you think it will harm our society, harm our economy, because we don't need to have any agricultural company anymore? So if it will harm our economy as a whole?
Thank you. Very good question. I did not say that homeowners would be producing everything for themselves. My statement was that I believe that full-time farmers, which there are very few of, and even if we multiply in great numbers, which is not looking enormously promising, it's improving, that those who are farming as a profession full-time should be focused on growing protein sources, the engine of the diet, if you will, which are the cereal grains and the pulses, you know, the beans, and to some degree as well animal protein, whether it's from meat or dairy products. And that homeowners, whether they be whether you have a tiny plot or a full backyard and front yard, should be growing those things that farmers are currently turning themselves into contortions to produce, which are these highly perishable fruits and vegetables. Now, why do we do that? Why do I do that as a major cornerstone of my farm? It's because it pays well. But we have to shift that dynamic. I'm talking about feeding the future. If we're going to feed the future, if we're going to have any chance whatsoever of feeding populations as they are currently growing in some parts of the world, then we are going to have to spread the responsibility of food production over the society as a whole, not just among 1% or 2%, which is how it stands. So that's my statement. And that those who are growing at home on a smaller scale, on a plot, small plot, a backyard, can grow their own fruits and vegetables. It's easy to do. It's going to be better. And let those who have the larger scale production units grow those food items that we cannot do without. So, yeah, thank you. It was a very good question. Anybody else? Like the talking stick, passing the talking stick.
I was sort of along those lines. Would you expect that every family that has a land to do this would do so? I mean, I keep thinking about, you know, the parents who have their full-time jobs, both mom and dad work, or maybe the single mom or single dad. They come home from a full-time job and have another full-time job as a parent. So is there a way to sort of supplement the land with stewards, supplementary stewards?
Yeah, so that's good. Well, it's kind of like being in politics, you know. I'm throwing out the big ideas. I'm talking about the restructuring of our society. Don't ask me for the details. but seriously, that's a very valid point, and it's one, we were talking about it earlier in a class that I sat in on, that we... And I did refer to it in my talk, that we forget that there are people who cannot afford to take part in this wonderful renaissance around food that's taking place, or that we think is taking place. It's actually taking place amongst a very small and narrow segment of society, and that renaissance should be available to everyone. How do we do that? You know, I think that that we need to build into our education system a sense of honor and respect, as I said, to using one's hands and to doing those things like growing food as a child, so that as you grow up and get older, that becomes not just something that you squeeze in because you have to, but something that's really important to you, important to your soul, and important to your diet, you know. This is a long-term perspective. I don't think some of these things will be easily legislated without the educational system to support them. It's why when I say remove everyone's lawns effective immediately, that everyone can say that. The important part is we have to educate those who have lawns and are homeowners how to make that transition. Okay, and I'm really good at probably, I probably didn't answer your question, but okay, thank you.
We have one question coming here from right in front of you.
Where are you, whoever's talking? Oh, you're way down here, yeah.
I was glad you mentioned urine. And urine is a good source of phosphorus?
Phosphorus, yeah.
I learned two things about urine this summer that I want to share, because one is there's a new exhibit from this summer at the National History Museum in Washington, and it's of an Alaskan community, an Inuit community that's completely self-sustaining. And one of the things that amazed me is that they save all their urine, and they re-put it not only into their agriculture, but, I mean, they make clothes out of fish skin, which they strengthen with human urine. And it's everyone participates. No one wastes a drop. Yeah. So I learned that in July. It's a very good exhibit. The second thing was I was in London on a trip with my daughter, and she asked the question that I never, as a French professor, want anyone to ask in Paris is, she says to my friend, can you drink the water? And he answers her, yes, it's only gone through 9 Londoners before you.
Gone through what?
9 Londoners.
In other words,
they purify their waste matter, and it comes back as tap water. So I just wanted to share that because it's so important that we not waste. Like California has a big water shortage crisis, and just to get new ideas about not wasting what can be potentially valuable.
Yeah. Well, I'm not 100% sure about that, about the London water system being run exactly as described. But I do believe that and I didn't emphasize it enough. I used to talk more about soil and water at length. Water is a major future world issue. It is a current world issue. 80% of the world's fresh water is used in agriculture. A tiny, tiny fraction of that actually ever makes it to the intended plants or animals due to an incredibly inefficient means of transporting and distributing it. And, you know, we have an obligation as a society to really take a hard look at this, especially in the West, but not just in the West, everywhere. And I think that we can look to traditional cultures, in particular right here in this country. I spent a lot of time when I worked on my first book with the Hopi in Arizona, made many, many trips over a period of years to the Hopi mesas, to those places where you could walk out in the middle of the desert in the heat of the summer, 120 degrees. There is nothing around, there are no pipes, and there in the middle of the desert is a lush field of corn and beans and squash and melons. Never been watered. Okay. We know that there are wonderful methods and techniques for dry farming. I grow tomatoes without water. I dry farm tomatoes. The result of which is not only conserving an incredibly precious resource, but producing tomatoes that taste better than anything you can ever grow under any other system. Because as the grape growers know, it concentrates the sugars and the flavor, right? So we really need to be thinking about that and wherever we are, and especially those of us who are farming. Really important. Yes. And a toast to human urine as well. Thank you. We have such a phobia around that stuff. It's crazy, you know. And we're paying the price. Who's got the talking stick?
Hello.
Oh, there you are. I have to be able to see you, too. So, do the house lights come up anymore? Go ahead. You can talk with low light.
Hi. Yeah. I just have a comment to the student above me about how to make gardening feasible, how to make it work. In fact, here at Dickinson, we have a very successful community garden, and that is everybody pitches in to help. So I find it. This community gardening idea, very, very, very good, and I've really gotten into it. But I have a question about something that you mentioned about railroads and using rail as transportation. And the first question that came up in my mind was coal and the problems behind that.
Coal and
rail, or yeah. you know, I don't, I'm just curious on how you would use rail transportation.
Mm-hmm. Well, rail is not, there's not necessarily a relationship between coal and rail. I mean, there is a historical relationship between coal and rail, but rail is actually, I'm talking about railroads, you understood that. Maybe that term rail is not something that was understood, but I'm talking about trains. Did you get that part? Yeah, okay. I just want to make sure. I traveled to different countries and places, and I have to remember that, you know, the terminology, the language can be different. No, I mean, until really the early mid-1980s, as I said, the majority of food, the majority, was not transported by trucks in the way we do it now, and planes, and moved around by trains, okay? And train transportation, rail transportation, both for human passengers and for freight, is relative to many other things that we know is incredibly efficient. It really is. Relative. And my point is that we have a construct that's arrived in the last 4 or 5 years about local food, which is I don't know what that means. It is a construct because where do you draw the line at local? What is local? You know, and that we really could, in my mind, we should be looking back to a form of transportation that I think works incredibly well, not just for ourselves but for those products that we grow and produce and want to distribute. I live in British Columbia now. I grew avocados commercially and citrus in California. For all those years when I was down there, it was a big part of my farming life. And I am not willing to give up my avocados and citrus. If I have to paddle my kayak down the West Coast to pick up a load, that's what I'll do. but I think that we can be far more creative and not imagine what I consider to be a narrow construct that all of our food has to come from within Carlisle, if we're going to eat in Carlisle. You know, it's not going to happen. That actually there is a much broader region that you could draw from and still move those foods around in a reasonable and sustainable manner. And I don't know if any of that made any sense, but I think I'm getting tired. Anybody else?
Yeah, the next question is coming from your left up there.
Hi. I don't know. I was thinking, you were talking about like engaging the youth. I was wondering, what do you think the best way to engage youth, like to reconnect youth with the idea of like being connected with your food and the food industry, I guess?
Okay. So now I'm realizing if it's hard for me to hear you in the audience, how was it listening to me? The acoustics are challenging, huh? Or were you able to understand me well? Okay. So how, if I understood it correctly, how do we involve youth in agriculture, is that right? Well, I mean, my simple answer really is for us to model and demonstrate that, first of all, that you can make a decent living doing it. I really think it's going to be a hard sell, and I've watched it because I get probably 100 requests for apprenticeships every year. I take two or three people, and I've watched people, and people are young people, not just young people. All people are very excited about this movement and about being on a farm, usually for the first week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And then by mid-July, they start dropping off. It's hard work. It's demanding work. It's incredibly satisfying work. But if you are doing that work and if you're thinking about it as a long-term profession, I think you want to know that you can make enough to be able to put your children into college like everyone else and to do the kinds of things that other professionals do. So I'm talking about parity, that we have to create a system where farmers are earning incomes on parity with other professionals. You know.
Yes.
Are you the same person that agreed with that other thing? That's two things. That's great. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what an amazing thing for me is I have people come up to me and they will bicker with me because my strawberries are 25 or 50 cents a basket, or in some cases even a dollar a basket, more than the ones that are coming from California that are in the supermarket, right? And I think to myself now, okay, would that person be negotiating with their doctor or their lawyer or their therapist? Probably not. But if they paid a farmer to make a decent living and supported agriculture on a level that it deserves support, we probably wouldn't need so many doctors or lawyers or therapists. And you know, I think that it's a big, it's really where the line is drawn. You see people are so excited about all this, but I watch some of the same people, they come to the market and you can see, you know, and it's usually the ones that are the most, that want to negotiate the most, are the ones with the BMW keys and the silk chiffon blouse. And you know, we have gotten used to a cheap food system in this country, which has been unwritten but exists. We pay something like 10 cents on the dollar. But how many people would look for the cheapest television set or car? You know, it doesn't work that way. But they will for the cheapest food. It's a matter of priorities in many cases. It really is. Did I answer the youth question? No. That's good. I'm doing a really good job here tonight. So let's take another one. Keep it moving.
We just have time for one more question, unfortunately.
Let's take two more. We're going to let you go and then Neil, right? Neil goes last. Better be good, Neil.
Well, I think the next one is coming up from that same corner. So.
Oh, are they walking out? What? Who?
Your next question.
Okay, three more then. That one, and that one. We'll go quick. Yeah.
Hi. I recently did a project about urban agriculture, and I got to explore a lot about it. And I got really excited about it. I'm like one of those people that you're talking about. I hope I don't fall off the face of the earth. But my question was, do you think that sustainable urban agriculture can feed the world? And I guess in thinking about that, I wanted to know, I mean, in terms of the first steps that we would take, it seems like education is one of them, and sort of institutionalizing it, creating centers for learning, places where people can get seeds, where people can learn about the land, and things like that. And I was wondering if you thought that would come from the municipality of cities, like, or private organizations, or how is this going to get started? Are people, individuals, going to have to organize themselves?
Okay, that's a big question. Well, the answer to the first question, do I think, and I'll separate the term sustainable. You said sustainable urban agriculture. Well, I'll say it the way it can feed the world. No, is the answer. You know, it's a fairly common and a really good question. The problem we have, you see, is that we have populations that are out of control. And feeding world populations at current rates is not an agricultural problem. It's a population problem that we're facing. There is no system of agriculture that can feed world populations if they continue to grow at the rates they're growing, especially when you consider some of the limitations that are already getting critical, such as water and phosphorus, et cetera. We need to address population as a social and cultural issue and not as an agricultural issue. Okay, so that's my answer to that piece. You know. I think that... I will go a step further and say, you know, the urban agriculture movement is missing the perspective is too narrow, because the perspective tends to think that urban agriculture can feed cities. Not going to happen. Okay, we need to look at urban agriculture in the context of the broader environment around that city. We need to look at urban agriculture as not just what goes on in the city, but how what goes on in the city is integrated with what is happening in the peri-urban and rural areas. Okay, and what are the and recreating appropriate relationships with those areas so that our cities can be more sustainably fed. It is not going to happen for Philadelphia or Harrisburg or Detroit or Vancouver to be producing all of its food within the city, at least as it stands right now with the current land base that exists within those cities, even if every rooftop and every available lot was planted. Not going to happen. Okay. So that's the one question, and I think I'm only going to give you one because we have to keep moving. I can't even remember what the other ones are. Is that okay? I'm only going to do that one part. Give somebody else. Yeah. And Neil gets to end after this lady here. Go ahead. Speak up.
Yeah, I'm loud anyway. But I had a question related to that, but also what you're talking about previously about the costs of food and how people don't actually argue, or I mean, they do argue about the cost of their food, but they don't argue about their medical bill or, right, you know, other institutions that are very expensive. And so my question is, because like local food and organic products are so expensive, and even people who are aware that buying locally or buying organic is better for them than buying like mass-produced unorganic food, they know that, they just can't financially support it. What do you think are the steps to actually get there to where it is manageable for more people to purchase that food?
Yeah, that's a very, very important question. I mean, I have freely admitted that for most of the years I've been farming, the majority of food, which is organically grown food, that I have grown has gone to a very narrow segment of the society, and that's those who can afford it. And I don't feel that it's the responsibility of farmers to resolve an economic system that has created haves and have-nots. I want to see farmers in business year after year, and for them to do that, frankly, they have to charge even more than the prices I saw at the farmers market here today. Because I know that at those prices, they're barely making it work, which isn't enough, you know. So it's not, again, this is a broader societal question. So what are we doing? I mean, it may not be the responsibility of farmers to address this broader economic disparity, but so many of us, interestingly enough, have felt the need to address it in our own ways. For myself, it's been through setting up urban agricultural projects in extremely low-income neighborhoods, you know, here in North America, and providing support and advice and ways of doing it. I go out when I'm not farming in the wintertime, and I try to work on projects that allows me to address the broader issue, not by giving people food or selling them food below my cost of production, but teaching them how to grow food for themselves, creating economic and social enterprises based on food production, which allow that to happen, you know. And I think that's my approach. I think there are a lot of creative endeavors and projects that are happening all around North America to address this issue. But ultimately, we have to ask ourselves the fundamental question, how did we get here? How did we get here? We can put patches on it. We can address pieces of it. But we have enormous disparity in this country, and in fact, throughout North America and throughout the world, you know. So they're huge questions, but they need to be asked. They need to be looked at. You know. I'm sorry, I couldn't do a better job. And Neil.
Okay. Before I ask my question, Sarah Brylinski here suggested that in the spirit of the comment you made earlier about our farmers, our food producers, our rock stars, we actually have a large number of farmers and food producers here in the audience. And Sarah thought
them.
It would be a good idea. Please stand up so that we can see who you are.
Thanks for coming, you guys. It is like Tuesday night or something, or Wednesday night, isn't it? What are you doing here? What am I doing here? Ooh. Oh, I'm so glad I gave that up when I left California.
Okay, my question is also along the lines of cost, but on a different angle. That you'd said that, you know, we are very much addicted to the notion of cheap food in our society. And the examples that you were giving were the strawberries, the fresh produce. But your earlier recommendation for farmers is move out of that, grow grains, grow protein.
Yeah.
Now, our system is one in which, you know, the margins are hard enough on the very lovely looking fruits and vegetables. We grow grains as commodities. We buy them as commodities, where we like don't pay attention to quality at all.
Right.
How do we make this work? What needs to change? What are the obstacles for farmers to be able to grow grains in a system where the purchasers are Archer Daniel Midland's, it's Cargill, it's, you know, we have a system where 99% of our grain is being purchased by a food system that grinds it up into all kinds of things that sort of look like food.
That we don't
but
recognize.
Maybe aren't.
Yeah. No, that's a very good question. Well, let me talk about it from my personal experience first, and then I'll try to bring it out from there. I am growing, well, we did, the last 2 years we did 10 acres of grain, which is, you know, like a front lawn for, you know, these combines now that they build can harvest something like 20, some of them 20 acres in 30 acres in an hour. I have a 40-some-year-old New Holland 6600 combine with a 12-foot header on it. And it's like a lawnmower compared with these other ones. But it was affordable. It was $10,000, and I split the cost with three other people on the island. And after 2 years of doing grain, I realized this before I did. I recognized that, number one, I could not afford to grow grain and sell grain. I could only afford to sell flour, okay, first of all. Second of all, that I could not afford to grow grain or flour unless, and here's the key point, it was part of my broader rotation. So if I view that grain production as a rotation crop, okay, then it all begins to make a little bit of sense for me. And if that rotation crop is also going to get a little bit of return, then it makes sense. Now, it's the same as, you know, the difference between selling liquid milk or selling cheese. There's a huge difference in the return. Obviously, there's a lot of infrastructure, there's more work, but the return is disproportionate, I should say. You guys probably, a bunch of you know this. Now, I could grow grain and sell and just load it into trucks and send it off to the distributor, and I'd probably last about a year or two. I could grow grain and whole grain and sell it in 5-pound bags. I'd do a little better. I could grind it and then put a label on it, beautiful flour and flour mixes and pancake mixes, and suddenly now I'm into a whole other world where it does begin to make some financial sense. We're also looking at more dry beans as part of that rotation because that there is. So I think that what's happening in the new frontier that has not been crossed until really the last 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years is the idea that it is possible, that it does make sense, and that we should be at least pursuing the idea of growing smaller production units of mixed grains closer to where people are consuming them in a regional manner, you know. And that we are going to we have a lot of work to do to figure out how to make that work financially, but I think it's possible. I think it's it is a question of scale as well. I am lucky now to be on a place that's large enough that allows me to see that grain production, and we hope next year, between the three of us, by the way, the other reason we're going to be successful is we're consolidating. Three small producers will have a staggering 60 or 70 acres of production next year. Wow. But that will have a significant impact on the 10,000 people on the island that are eating grain, right? And we're buying a full-scale grinder. We're going to do packaging. We're going to build it into something, you know. I don't know what we're calling the company. Like, it was going to be Salt Spring Grain. I keep thinking it's Old Guys Grain Company because there are three of us, and I'm the youngest of all three of them, you know. Well, the worst thing was that this year we had, you know, this transition movement. Are you familiar with that? It started in England. It's a movement to reconsider how we're living in various cities. And So we have a transitions movement on Salt Spring Island who came out to see me harvest my one of my neighbor's little grain field, which consisted of less than an acre. Now, what I didn't know is we had a hydraulic leak in the machine, and the fans were sucking vaporized hydraulic oil into the machine and coating his entire wheat crop. So they all came with their buckets, and they're scooping the grain into the buckets, you know, and then realizing that something is not quite right here, you know. So it was a really good lesson for people who are not growers to see this is one of the things that we have to deal with. This is what happens, you know. Anyway, I didn't answer your question. I think that what's going to happen is that we need to reshift the production of what we now call commodity products to smaller scale regional units, and that people are going to have to recognize the value of those products, the value as they once recognized the difference between organic and conventional production. They will recognize, they will taste the difference, because I get it from bakers that are eating my wheat and using my wheat. It is a dramatic difference. And they are going to be willing to pay for that difference. And if they're not willing to, we will force them to, because we have got to have buy-in here. This is not my job to shift the system. It's all of our jobs. And I'm talking about all of our, I'm talking about everyone who eats, which I assume is most of us. And I think that is the new frontier, really. That particular piece, I think, is the new frontier. Yeah. What's that? Yeah. I need you on my side. He's good, huh? I can't see him. He's totally in the dark. And he has a blue light above his head. I don't know what that means, you know. I have no idea what that means. It's some sort of thing that you guys have going on here in some cult here in Carlisle, I'm sure, you know. Oh, he's the head of the blue light cult, huh? Ooh, okay. Well, you notice you can't see him at all. Show yourself. All right, give him a hand. Woo! Yeah. Oh, you got it, man. Hey, you guys have been a wonderful audience. Thank you so much for having me.